KZSU-FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I'm going to do something initially here that I have not done heretofore. I just want to make a special statement. We're recording this show on August 4th, and I was very saddened to hear yesterday of the untimely passing of Professor John Barton at Stanford Law School. And I wanted to note it on the show because John was not only a wonderful man and very smart, but extremely generous and thoughtful and kind. And that combination is exceedingly rare and something that I know everyone that knows him and knew him will miss. So I just wanted to mention that up front, the passing of John Barton, and he and his family are in my thoughts and prayers, as I'm sure they are in the thoughts and prayers of many of the people who had the privilege of knowing him. I am very excited today to have on the show Professor Michael Heller of Columbia Law School, who's written a fascinating book called The Gridlock Economy, How Too Much Ownership Wrecks Markets, Stops Innovation, and Costs Lives. Ownership. That is a major focus of Hearsay Culture. Of course, a major focus of the show being intellectual property. And there's been a long-standing debate, although it's gotten heated more recently, about whether property and the property concepts are important or even required or even should be in the intellectual property arena. Here in The Gridlock Economy, Michael takes a look at how ownership actually, as the subtitle suggests, can become problematic not only in innovation but in the operation of our economy more broadly. When is there too much ownership? When are there too many property rights? When can those property rights get in the way of the public interest from a broad perspective? Now, Michael is someone who has written extensively in property. In fact, for those that don't know, he is the Lawrence A. Wayne Professor of Real Estate Law at Columbia Law School. And he's also served as the school's vice dean for intellectual life. He started writing The Gridlock Economy while he was a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. And he is joining us today from his office at Columbia Law School. Interestingly, and I think a good way to begin our discussion is really to actually read for you the last portion of page 198 of his book, where he closes the book. He says, "We create gridlock all the time, but tragedy is not our fate. Just as the European powers removed robber barons from the Rhine after 1815, we too can dismantle phantom toll booths in the economy today. With practice, we can spot and avert potential tragedies of the anti-commons. If ownership becomes too fragmented, we can creatively use politics, law, finance, and plain neighborliness to reassemble resources. Fixing our gridlock economy is a worthy and noble goal. By doing so, we can jumpstart innovation, save millions of lives, and unleash trillions of dollars in lost productivity. Let's unlock the grid." There's a lot of terms in that last paragraph. Michael, let's start our discussion. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
It's great to be here on Hearsay Culture.
Let's start off, Michael, but before we get into some of the terminology to for the listeners that aren't familiar, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your own background. How did you become interested in the particular issues that you discuss in The Gridlock Economy?
Well, the idea for this book actually came sitting in an airport, stuck on the ground waiting for a plane to take off. And I was wondering, why don't we just build some more runways, or why don't we build some more airports? And I started to look into that problem and realized that in the last 30 years in this country, the number of air travelers had tripled. We've only built one new airport. Only Denver is the only new one. And it turned out that it's impossible to build new runways, basically anywhere in the country, or new airports, because so many landowners or neighboring communities are able to block virtually every effort. So for me, it was that puzzle, or really more precisely that irritation of being stuck in the airport, that made me realize, boy, this is a very basic problem of design of property rights, and I wonder where else this appears. And as I started to look around, I saw that in place after place in our economy, we had the same type of problem, the problem of overly fragmented rights that were easy to break up, easy to subdivide land, but very hard to put back together. And many of those examples of two fragmented rights, it turns out, were in the area of intellectual property, which is really the focus of this show, in the area of patents, in the area of copyright, in the area of telecom licensing and spectrum licensing. And I realized that all of those problems are really the same problem, and they were a very fundamental problem in how we create and define property rights, which is an issue that I've been thinking about more broadly for over 20 years now. My earliest work was in creating property rights systems in developing countries.
Go ahead.
Oh,
and let's talk about that, because I think that's an interesting discussion that you have in the beginning of the book. You did some interesting work and some groundbreaking work in Moscow. Perhaps you could talk about that and your particular experience there that you note in the book that helped crystallize this problem for you.
Well, when I first worked in Moscow, it was still the Soviet Union, and they invited the World Bank, which is who I used to work for. They invited the World Bank in to think about, if we were to become a more market-oriented society, how would we do that? So my job was to work with government there on how to create property rights, private property rights, in land and in housing. How do you create a free market economy in land and housing? So this was in the early 90s. I was working mostly out of Moscow, trying to help in the transition from a Marxist economy to a modern capitalist economy. And one of the first steps was privatization of industry, privatization of housing, privatization of stores. And we had some very strange puzzles. A year after privatization had been completed for stores, the deputy prime minister, the person who was in charge of the reform of the economy, asked me and my team a question, which then, 20 years later, became the core, one of the core examples in this book. And the question was this. He noticed that storefronts had been privatized, but they were still sitting empty. They were heated, they were secure, they were well lit, and they were completely empty. And across the street, this is in Moscow in the dead of winter, so it was 40 degrees below zero when I was there this one time. In the dead of winter, you had flimsy metal kiosks that were full of everything. Anything you wanted to buy, from flowers to vodka to bread, you would buy from a kiosk. But the stores across the sidewalk were empty. And the question that the deputy prime minister asked me is, why? Why is it that people, these merchants, don't move in from the cold? And it was a real puzzle. I had a week to come back to him with an answer. And what that meant was walking around Moscow and talking to people, what had happened and how we created property rights that led to stores being basically private but not used at all. And the answer turned out to be a fundamental mistake in how we created property rights, and one that is, as we'll discuss over the next hour, much more general in our economy and extremely costly in ways that are very hard to see. So in Moscow, what I discovered was that it was easy to set up a kiosk. You just bribed one government official and paid one mafia gang for protection, and you could have your kiosk up and running fairly quickly, overnight, really. So that was a very simple property rights regime. It wasn't legal, but it was simple. By contrast with stores, the way we had privatized was we were in a rush. We were afraid of the communists coming back. We wanted to create stakeholders in the new society. So what we largely did was simply take the old socialist rights and label them private rights and said you can now trade them and assemble them, buy them, and sell them. So in a single storefront, you might have one owner who owned the right to sell the store, and a different one who had the right to lease out that same store, and a third one who had the right to occupy that same store, and on and on. So we took a standard bundle of rights in a market economy and broke it up among many different people. And unless every one of them agreed, nobody could use the store. And that's indeed what happened in those first 2 years of transition in Moscow. You had too many owners of a single storefront, and conversely, you had too little use. So the underuse was very visible. That is, there were empty storefronts. But the reason was much harder to see. It was a mistake in the way that we initially created property rights. And that phenomena of too many rights or too fragmented or divided rights leading to too little use is one that I crystallized as this term, a tragedy of the anti-commons, which you mentioned in your introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And that tragedy, the tragedy of too many owners leading to too many to too little use, is one that generalizes across the modern economy. It's not just, it turns out, not just to be a sort of abstract, faraway example from, you know, halfway around the world, but something that affects us every day in our day-to-day lives. It's why our cell phones don't work so well. It's why all sorts, the number of diseases that could have been cured, we don't have drugs for. It's a very basic phenomenon in our economy, what I call gridlock, that leads to hidden losses for every one of us in our everyday lives.
The issue of the tragedy of the anti-commons, of course, has its antecedent in the tragedy of the commons. We've discussed the tragedy of commons with previous guests on the show, but I think since that is not a term that we generally use in everyday discussion, it would be good to define it. Of course, I could simply walk away from the microphone now, and you could spend the next 45 minutes discussing what the tragedy of the commons and anti-commons are. But perhaps for those people who aren't familiar, what is your nutshell definition of the tragedy of the commons, and then the flip side, if you will, of the anti-commons?
The tragedy of the commons was describing the phenomena where, let me give you a simple example. Say you have an ocean as a commons. Anyone is free to take fish out. Or you have the air. Anyone is free to pollute. Or a field that anybody is free to put more sheep on. Each individual comes to that ocean or air or field and says, boy, from my own individual standpoint, it makes sense for me to take the fish out today. If I leave them, somebody else will take them. Or to put another sheep on and graze more, or to pollute the air some. Because if I don't, other people will, and if I do pollute or take the fish out, I get the full benefit. So a bunch of individuals make rational decisions to use a common resource, but the net collective cost of society, this is where the tragedy part comes in, is that the fish are all depleted. They're hunted to extinction. Or the field is overgrazed, or the air becomes so polluted that we all choke. So the notion of a tragedy of the commons is simply the idea that there are cases, there are social settings in which individuals making rational, wealth-maximizing, ordinary decisions sum up to collective tragedy. Mm-hmm. There's no one to blame. Everyone's doing what... Everyone's making the correct calculation from their individual standpoint, but in the tragedy of the commons, the sum of those individual decisions is it's the destruction of the resource. So that's an image or a term that was coined by a biologist, Gary Hardin, about 30 years, now I guess 40 years ago, to describe the problems in overpopulation. But that he took the notion of from the overpopulation has now been generalized to tens of thousands of examples of resources that we depend on, like the air or the oceans, that are subject to this phenomena, the phenomena of individual rational decisions summing to collective destruction of the resource. So that metaphor was actually, it was a crucial metaphor for jumpstarting the environmental movement and for getting people thinking about how do you solve this tragedy. And the standard solutions for solving tragedies of the commons partly have been regulation, command and control, telling people how much they can fish or how much they can pollute. But that form of solution to tragedy of the commons is really not one that's so much in favor today, and much less so since the fall of socialist economies around the world.
Mm-hmm.
The other standard solution to a tragedy of the commons is to privatize. If you're an individual owner, say you own the private lake, then you invest in it today. You don't take all the fish out today. You invest in it today so you have more and bigger fish for tomorrow. One of the great engines of conservation in our society is private property rights. And the reason that private property rights are this engine of conservation and investment and growth and wealth creation in substantial measure is that private property rights have this hidden function of being often the best solution to tragedies of the commons.
Mm.
And because private property or privatization is such a powerful solution, it has become an all-encompassing solution. If some private property is good, we have the notion that more private property must be better.
Yeah.
So when we talk about property out in the world, we tend to view it as a spectrum. At one end, historically, we've said there's the commons, property that is unowned, that anybody can use. That is subject to destruction through overuse, through the tragedy of the commons. And at the other end, we have private property, which leads to conservation and efficient decision-making. So when that's your vision of the continuum of property, you can't privatize too much. And what I discovered is that that's actually that there's a fatal mistake that in that assumption, that there actually is another hidden half of the continuum of property beyond private property, that just as you can have too few owners in a commons, you can have too many owners in an anti-commons, just as what I call an anti-commons. Just as you can have too overuse and destruction in the tragedy of the commons, you can have underuse and also have wealth destruction in a tragedy of the anti-commons. And once you expand the property spectrum to include both tragedies of the commons at one end and anti-commons at the other, it really radically reshapes your intuition about what is private property. This very familiar concept, something we all feel we know in our gut, turns out not to be the end point of ownership, but it's a fine balance between overuse and underuse, commons and anti-commons, too few owners and too many owners. And this half of the spectrum of anti-commons ownership, the spectrum of where we have too many owners, turns out to be absolutely pervasive in our modern economy. More and more, as the structure of innovation in this country has shifted in the last decade or two, we have more and more examples of resources being stranded in anti-commons ownership rather than in well-functioning private property. So I coined the term a tragedy of the anti-commons, building on a term, anti-commons, that was coined by Frank Michelman, to try to capture this phenomena of going as a possibility, try to make visible the possibility that as we cure tragedies of the commons, tragedies of resource overuse, we can tip, we can go past a well-functioning private solution and tip into resource waste, tip into underuse in the tragedy of the anti-commons. So what I'm trying to do is make visible a whole category, give a language for a whole category of social dilemmas that are very costly, but very hard to see.
We're talking with Professor Michael Heller of Columbia Law School, author of The Gridlock Economy. Yeah, Michael, that your last point leads me to a question I wanted to ask, which I think I think is appropriate here. Your purpose for writing this book is an interesting one because, in a sense, while you're building on some previous economic thought, it appears that your goal for the book is to identify this problem in a way that has not been, in it, from an angle that has not, up to now, been its primary focus or the primary way that we see the problem. Am I stating that correctly, or do you have an alternate goal for the book?
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, when I was drafting this book, my spell checker kept underlining the word underuse. Word doesn't accept underuse as an English word. Overuse is a word that's been in English for hundreds of years. Underuse, is still not a word in Microsoft Word, at least. Hmm. And the red squiggles under underuse seems to me they're a signal, right? But the non-existence of a word like underuse can be as telling as its presence. If we don't have a term to describe a social condition like underuse, it means that condition doesn't even exist in most people's minds. So it's been very easy to overlook the hidden cost in our society of underuse, of fragmented ownership. And I don't think we can really fix the problem until we have a common language for talking about gridlock. For example, even in Scrabble, until 3 years ago, the word underuse wasn't accepted. It was a bluff. You would lose your turn if you played it and were challenged.
Huh.
And yet the phenomenon of underuse is absolutely all around us. I mean, I assume we'll get to this maybe after the break, but we're talking fairly abstractly about terms like commons and anti-commons.
Right.
And I hope that what I can get across to your listeners is that this isn't at all an abstract problem. These are absolutely everyday problems that we swim in, not just as intellectual people concerned with intellectual property, but just as ordinary citizens going about our day. So there are a lot of concrete examples I'm hoping that we can talk about a little bit.
Absolutely, and that is something I think we'll get to after the break. And to tie into that area, you also coin the phrase "phantom toll booths." This concept, and I'll allow you to expand on it. But this concept of almost basically rent seeking or permission areas within the process of attempting to bring a product to market or to innovate or to so forth and so forth. And if you don't pay the toll, you cannot go forward. We can expand on that, but I want to take on up front as almost a teaser, if you will, to some of these concrete examples, the point that you make that we are losing trillions of dollars as a result of the gridlock economy. How is that happening?
Well, we can go sector by sector through the economy and try to tease out the losses. So let me give you an example from telecom. It used to be the case 10, 20 years ago that the U.S. was the global leader in telecom. And now, today, we've fallen out of the top 10, almost out of the top 20, depending on what measure you use for broadband capacity or penetration or speeds, lots of different measures. But by any measure, the U.S. has dropped substantially out of the top group. So one way to measure the cost of, and then I'll explain in a second, a substantial reason for that drop has been a hidden example of gridlock. And so when you can measure the cost of that gridlock by looking at countries where they solved the problem of getting wireless high-speed broadband up and running, and the U.S. where we really haven't in quite the same way. So what sort of economic services would be available, and what's the cost of not having them in our economy, has been estimated by one economist, Charles Ferguson, to measure, as you mentioned, in the trillions. So how is that a gridlock problem? In the U.S., when cellular licenses, for example, were first given out by the FCC 27 years ago, they broke the U.S. up into 734 small locations and gave out two licenses in each of those. There was no such thing as national wireless. What there was 734 little duchies, each controlled by different licensees. So the initial step in the U.S. of creating the very first national wireless network required the assembly of hundreds of individual licenses. It is still the case today in the U.S. that over 90% of U.S. of U.S. broadcast spectrum is dead air. That is simply not used at all. And that's an artifact of the way we've created property rights in broadcast spectrum. We have thousands and thousands of owners, if you look across the spectrum as a whole and nationally as a whole, thousands and thousands of owners, the very geographically limited, use-limited, non-transferable bits of spectrum, which means that when people who want to assemble spectrum for next-generation uses simply don't have it available. So, for example, when Nextel assembled its not very good national network, the push-to-talk network, they went and bought up thousands of pizza delivery licenses and taxicab dispatch licenses and knit those together to make their not very good network. We simply don't have the capacity in this country, because of this underlying fragmentation or gridlock, to have next-generation wireless services. And the result has been that we don't. For example, real-time multimedia, you can't do in this country on your cell phone the way you can in Japan. All kinds of shopping and medical diagnostic and so on. Technologies simply don't exist in this country. The whole industries that exist elsewhere don't exist here. And when Charles Ferguson, the economist, was measuring these costs, he was summing up across our economy the costs of those missing or lost or gridlocked technologies. So that's just one example from the area of telecom. But as we go in sector after sector of a modern high-tech economy, more and more, in order to innovate, what we need is to assemble large numbers of separately owned pieces of either patented or copyrighted or licensed ownership in order to get to whatever the next new technology is. So to go back to your question about phantom toll booths, one way to understand the FCC's initial decision when they created the first cellular licenses is that they created a series of toll booths. You had to go across 734 of them. You had to get through every one of those toll booths in order to get a single national network. And anybody, any of your listeners who are entrepreneurs is very familiar with the problem of the series of often regulatory permissions that you need in order to move forward with a product. Or if you're a drug developer, a pharmaceutical developer, with a series of patents that you have to license in order to bring your drug to market. It's those series of steps that you have to take, every one of which is crucial to the final product, that I call phantom toll booths, blocks on the way to innovation.
We're talking with Professor Michael Heller of Columbia Law School on hearsay culture at KZSU-FM Stanford, author of the book The Gridlock Economy. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM Stanford, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse broadcasting. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can merely go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the website, and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope you consider making a donation to KZSU to continue the diverse programming that has been its hallmark. Michael, when you talk about this issue of too many owners, you talk about the history of ownership in your book. And this is not a new problem, in the sense that we've had owners of property and we've had the basic property rights of allowing ownership. And indeed, at least in the United States, we've had for a few hundred years the basic utilitarian purpose or intellectual property rights, which boil down to if we want people to innovate, we need to give them an incentive to do so. And that incentive is, you know, either a limited monopoly or just control over the use of a work of authorship in the case of copyright and so forth. But ownership is not a new concept, and too many owners is not a new concept. In your book, you weave quite an interesting history where you talk about everything from, as I mentioned in the closing, robber barons on the Rhine in the 19th century in Europe to the Oyster Wars. How does this history, and I'm not asking you to give the entire history of the book, but how does this history inform your analysis of the problem as it exists today?
Well, good. That's a great question. Private property, as I mentioned a little earlier, is really the great engine of wealth creation. So usually private property leads to more wealth. And usually, for example, patents and copyright lead to more wealth. They provide the incentives for innovation. They provide incentives for disclosure. What I've tried to crystallize in this book is that there can be a phenomena of too many property rights that are too hard to assemble. So it's not that private property is a bad thing. It's that it needs to be structured in ways that are that maximize the benefit that we get from a society from the actions of self-interested, highly motivated individuals who control resources. Usually we get it right, but what happens over time is that property regimes become less and less attuned to the social circumstances, or potentially less and less attuned to social circumstances in which they exist. So let me give you a little bit more concrete example. In this country, the basic patent law dates from 1952. We haven't had a major overhaul of patent law for over 50 years. That was a time before we had discovered DNA. That was a time before we had the internet. And patent law was designed to support a style of industrial innovation that characterized the 1950s very well and characterizes the modern economy today almost not at all. So what's happened over the last generations is we've seen a real shift, an unnoticed shift, a quiet shift in how America innovates. It used to be that you went and you made a discovery, you got a patent, and you brought that to market. But today, if you take your cell phone, pick up your cell phone, there are several thousand patents that read on a single cell phone. Or if you take money out of an ATM, that requires the bank to license, again, several thousand patents to make the ATM transaction work. Hmm. So the nature of modern innovation has actually shifted quite substantially from a single patent to a single product to a new style of innovation, which is largely about assembly of multiple patents. But the property rights regime simply hasn't kept up. So let me give you another concrete example. I suggested one area of enormous social cost in how far behind the U.S. has fallen from telecom gridlock. Here's an example from patent gridlock. Starting around 1980, the U.S. Began encouraging universities to patent what they found. And the idea was to encourage them to commercialize their discoveries. And the Supreme Court also said that life forms potentially were patentable. And the combination of that court decision and that congressional prod to universities spurred the biotech revolution. We had billions and billions of dollars of private money going into very basic scientific research because of the possibility of getting property rights protection at the other end. So today, several decades later, we have close to 40,000 patents on related to DNA discoveries. Say, though, that which is great. So that's the upside of creating more and stronger patent rights. But the gridlock story is a hidden downside, which is this. Say that you're a drug developer who, say that what you're making is a diagnostic tool that's going to look for some genetic defect, and you need to have 1,000 genes on a single, chip that you put in a machine to test where the location of the individual's genetic defect is. Unless you can license all 1,000 of those genes, you don't have a product that delivers the information that the patient needs. The people who make these sorts of diagnostic tools are finding more and more that there's a thicket of patents out there which block them from bringing to market the product that they potentially can offer people who are sick. And I've had now at this point a number of drug company executives, CEOs, and scientists talk to me about specific diseases where they're fairly confident there would be real cures or treatments available that they simply can't bring to market because of so much congestion in the patent area. And the congestion is the problem of walking into an auditorium with 50 or 100 patent owners and having to negotiate with every single one of them to license the pieces of technology that these drug developers need in order to bring to market new life-saving technologies. So in area after area, from cancer to Alzheimer's, there are drugs that could and should be available to save people's lives. Again, in the numbers in the millions, that aren't available because the property rights regime is so congested. Just like we can't build runways because the communities at the end can block, just like the stores couldn't be used in Moscow, just like we can't get national wireless. Similarly, in the area of drug development, too many patents can lead to too little drug development. It's another example of hidden gridlock. Where do you go to protest? Who do you talk to?
Right.
When you have so many owners, no one of them is holding up the problem. It's just that the drug companies that are doing that are allocating their R&D money are allocating it towards spin-off of existing drugs rather than towards creation of new ones. It's the drugs that don't come to market that are lost. But those are very hard ones to focus people's attention around because they aren't there.
The concepts and the concrete examples that you give, I think, are hard to argue with. And I think because of the nature of the problem, the logical next question is, okay, I accept that this is a problem. What do we do? So there are a variety of potential solutions to this problem, and I think we should get into a few of them. And I'll start off with the most extreme example. I mean, there are respected economists and lawyers who have made the argument that the entire intellectual property system or large portions of it is so flawed and so problematic that it should be thrown out entirely. Earlier in the history of hearsay culture, David K. Levine, no relation, and Michele Boldrin were on discussing their book Against Intellectual Monopoly, where they've made the argument from an economic perspective that the patent system as well as the copyright system are failures and should go out the window. As you've mentioned, there have been several recent books coming out that have come out recently, and from Mark Lemley and Dan Burke and others, Mike Moyer, who have suggested various ways to reform the patent system, the copyright system itself, with the fair use battles and other issues involving damages. And again, this recording is happening on August 4th, where the Tenenbaum case has recently been decided, where you have someone who illegally downloaded music and has had a over $600,000 judgment entered against them. Putting aside the legality of that behavior, there are issues involving damages. Trademark law has its flaws. Even trade secret law, which is an area that I write in, has its problems because of the broad definition of a trade secret can block things that may not be valuable. All of this, to me, at least an argument would be, Michael, is to say, you know what? We don't need this system entirely. We need to just throw it out and start anew. What do you say to that?
My argument, my book doesn't, the arguments that I make don't go that far.
Mm-hmm.
And not say that those arguments are wrong, but that they aren't justified by the problem that I've discovered. The problem that I've discovered is, again, it's a pervasive one. It goes across the economy, but the answer is not necessarily the case that the answer to too many patents is to have no patents, or the answer to too strict copyright law is to have no copyright law. The way that I understand property rights is that what we're trying, at least from a utilitarian standpoint, which is one part of how we justify, or how I justify property rights, is to maximize social welfare. And that means encouraging people to innovate and encouraging, giving them incentives to innovate. So it is not necessarily the case that patents always deter innovation, just the opposite. In many cases, patents do seem to be pro-innovation spurring. And similarly with copyright, that does seem to have create an awful lot of valuable economic activity. The goal isn't, from my standpoint at least, an all-or-nothing approach. The goal for me is to introduce a potential hidden cost of poorly structured patent law or poorly structured copyright law. And once you say that, once you say there is this hidden cost, and the hidden cost is an artifact of how we structured patent law and how patent law interacts with the economy today, I think the challenge then is to come up with creative solutions that are attentive both to overcoming gridlock, but also to spurring people to innovate and to encouraging a liberty or autonomy interest in people's discoveries and people's creations. I think it's a balance rather than an all or nothing.
And if that's the case, Michael, I mean, it raises an interesting point. Mark Lemley and Dan Burke have written a book recently where they make the argument that we don't ultimately have a patent system, quote-unquote. What we have are, and what we should have, are patent laws that at least take into effect and consider industry-specific issues. And they come up with, as I've said, a variety of ways to change various aspects of patent law in order to address the problems that they identify. If we're not going to toss the IP system out the window, is your book suggesting, and as you've mentioned, that there are areas in which the intellectual property system works, and in those areas we shouldn't do much, if anything, to change the law, but that there are other areas where, as you mentioned, the phantom toll booth has become an engine of the gridlock economy. With that background, I guess my question boils down to, given the examples that you've identified in the book, many of which you've discussed today, is it fair to say that one way to view the IP system is literally a system that works very well in some cases and not in others, and to focus our attention to perhaps changing the law in those specific industries?
That description sounds right to me. I'm very sympathetic with Mark Lemley and Dan's work. I think that they're spot on. And what they're addressing in that book and in the point that you raised is, or leveraging, is an interesting distinction between how we treat copyright law in this country in general and how we treat patent law in general. In general, copyright law tends to be much more industry-specific, which itself has pros and cons, right? The pro is that if you have more industry-specific copyright law, you can have copyright law more finely attuned to balancing the concerns of consumers and producers in that specific area, say at sound recordings. By contrast, patent law historically and still today is much more unified, doesn't make distinctions among industries, which means that it's not as finely tuned to the concerns of particular areas of innovation, but it also means that it's less susceptible to industry capture because you have competing interests. You have software versus pharmaceutical company. You have banking versus biotech. So you have real competing interests that lead to political gridlock, but they also lead to patent law having been captured by one side versus another. But by contrast, copyright law, you do have a real problem of industry capture, which offsets some of the gains of specificity in particular areas. So what's the point? The point there is that, if we get back to my larger point, which is I don't see a single solution. What I'm hoping to do is to introduce into these debates about the future of copyright law, of mashups and remixes and how we deal with sampling culture in a copyright society on the one side, how we deal with patent law reform in a world where innovation has shifted from a single patent often to the need to assemble thousands of patents, how we deal with spectrum reform in an area where we now need national spectrum rather than a very highly localized spectrum often. So the reforms have to be specific to, targeted to each of those areas, but in each of them we need to be attentive to the potential losses from gridlock. And once we are, we can begin to think about creative ways in each of those areas that we might rejigger, restructure property rights to make it easier to assemble property rights, patents, copyrights, or whatever, where that's economically valuable to do so. So copyright collectives are one example. Mm-hmm. Patent pools are another example. Various forms of mandatory licensing are other mm-hmm. examples. There are many different tools that we have for assembly, both voluntary and in the market, and through potential regulatory or legislative tweaks.
We're talking with Professor Michael Heller, author of The Gridlock Economy on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, Michael, you know, one of the areas that you talk about a bit in the book, which would come to mind anyone who thinks about this from a technology standpoint, is, of course, the open source model for software development. Is the open source model one that is a potential solution to a broader array of problems? I mean, assuming for the moment that, for example, the battles involving broadcast spectrum are not already lost causes, which I think, as you indicate in your book, you don't believe that they are, that we can make changes and fix the problem, but it may take hard decisions. Is the open source model a model that we can turn to directly address the problems of the gridlock economy?
Absolutely, yes. In many contexts, open source will be a solution to gridlock. But even within open source, though, there are problems. So, for example, one open source coder wrote me about the problem he was having. He was putting together a product built on open source modules, but each of the open source modules that he was using came with different open source licenses. Mm-hmm. And when he started to stack them all up, it made it essentially impossible for him to build a new open source product, on top of a stack of open source licenses that were each incompatible with the other. And he discovered that in his industry, at least, it was necessary to use proprietary models because he simply couldn't overcome the problem of conflicting open source licenses. So open source can be a solution, but even open source isn't a magic bullet. It doesn't answer all gridlock problems. It's just another tool that we should have. And in the book, I talk about a toolkit of solutions. It's a very valuable tool, but it's mm-hmm. not the only tool.
That's something we could talk about here in the remaining 10 or so minutes on the show. In your lengthy discussion of the market for oysters, which is a fascinating one that we don't have time to get into here, but I do commend to any listener who picks up the book to take a look at, you talk about the regime of making these decisions involving, and I'm quoting from the book, always involves a subtle and intricate amalgam of ownership techniques, including conquest and its analogs, market solutions such as trade and privatization, formal and informal customary norms, direct state regulations such as minimum catch sizes, and indirect regulations such as state-sanctioned monopolies. Now, this, when I go through that, I'm kind of reminded of Larry Lessig's work in Code, where he identifies the myriad factors that make up what we would call internet regulation. Focusing on the future now in terms of what we can do, again, I mean, the economy is in tough shape. We now, you know, in the last year, suddenly the government owns entities like, or has substantial ownership in entities like AIG, something that we would have all laughed about probably a couple of years ago. And if you didn't laugh about it, then you probably have done well in this economy. We have this amalgam of issues from an economic standpoint, and as you identify, this is a complicated problem. As we look forward, and this is kind of the unfair crystal ball question, you sound an optimistic note that no failure is automatic, which I think is an interesting one that we should explore. How is it that despite all of these issues, you take the position that human beings can still fix these problems and it doesn't have to be this way?
All of the problems I discuss in the book, from missing drugs to slow cell phones to dropped phone calls to sitting in airports, these are all artifacts of choices that of choices that we've made politically about how to structure property rights, how to give people incentives to do or not do things that had at one point, usually historically, were fairly well attuned to the social circumstances that led to those decisions, but over time become less and less so. So we can change those choices. You know, we can make it easy. We can, for each of the examples that I give in the book, we can, once we are aware that this is a problem, once you're aware that we could have an Alzheimer's drug that would simply, a cure could be available, and it's not because technologically we have a problem, but because we have a property rights problem. Or the reason that we have such pathetic cell phone service in this country is not a technological problem, it's a regulatory problem. Once you realize that a lot of these underlying losses in productivity, in lives, in wealth, are artifacts of choices that we made politically at one point, you can begin to say, hey, we can change those choices. We have a lot of tools at our disposal. Open source is one. Patent pools is another. Copyright collectives is a third. Making tweaks to how we structure patent law. Making tweaks to what we consider fair use. So regulatory tweaks, there's philanthropic solutions, there's entrepreneurial solutions. But the first step to solving all these problems is to recognize that there is a problem. It's having language for talking about underuse, anti-commons, gridlock, for seeing that all of these problems are the same problem and talking about them. And once people can talk about them, I believe we'll be able to leverage, at least this is where my optimism comes from, is that at least so far, we haven't even recognized that this problem is pervasive through our economy, and the gridlock problem. And gridlock does result from choices that are not immutable. They aren't forces of nature. They are political choices. And once we recognize that those are choices we've made, we can begin to change them. So, for example, I mentioned that the patent law in this country basically dates 1952. It needs to be updated. And this isn't a left-right issue. There's been a bipartisan bill sponsored by Leahy and Hatch that came out of hearings at the FTC a couple of years ago on gridlock. And the FTC suggested legislation, and Republicans and Democrats have been working together to get it passed. It's very hard to pass because we have an independent problem of political gridlock on the Hill, which I don't focus on in the book, but change is hard. But the first step to change, first step to having this bill introduced, was recognizing that there is a problem. So your question was, I want to circle back to it. You mentioned the 100-year history of the Oyster War,
right,
between Maryland and Virginia on the Chesapeake Bay. Maryland and Virginia had oyster navies. People were with gunboats on the Chesapeake fighting each other. You mentioned Larry Lessig's code and the different mechanisms that Larry discusses for how you regulate the Internet, not just legal, but all the other mechanisms that surround that. And then you mentioned AIG, the meltdown in financial instruments, which it also turns out is a gridlock problem, that we now have structured and pooled and tranched mortgages so that you don't know who your lender is anymore. You now have 1,000 potential investors who own pieces of your mortgage. There's no one for you to phone at the other end of the line. So whether you're looking 100 years ago, you're looking at oysters, or you're looking at the Internet regulation, the way Larry does, or you're looking at AIG and financial meltdowns, all of those problems, all of that war, how we structure, how we fight over the Internet, how we pay our mortgages, all of those problems are linked by being artifacts of a set of decisions about the underlying property rights regime, about who owns what and how they own it, and how easy it is to put the pieces of ownership back together. Put the pieces of ownership back together when it's economically important to do so. So the gridlock story is to say, hey, it turns out that it often is pretty important to be able to put pieces of property back together. We're stuck with old-fashioned property law in patent and copyright, in telecom, in land. But we're in a new economy where being able to assemble resources has become much more important. And now it's time to begin thinking about how to do that. So we do have a bill on the Hill, which is stalled, but it's there, and probably it'll pass if we have some leadership, and similarly with copyright reform. There are areas for reform there that would solve a lot of the gridlock features that we see in the current, that currently lead to the sort of crazy decisions like came down against an individual music downloader.
Mm-hmm. For those,
the first step is to spot the problem.
For those that are listening, who are in the academic on the academic side and are thinking about how they can help from a research perspective, is there any empirical research or even writing that needs to be done to help establish this case for purposes of helping regulators get to this issue and resolve it?
There's been a lot of empirical work done on trying to measure the costs of gridlock in different sectors of the economy. And it turns out to be very hard to do, in part because you're trying to measure a counterfactual. How do you measure the loss to an economy from a drug that doesn't exist?
Right.
Or how do you discover even if there is gridlock, for example, in pharmaceutical development? How do you measure what drugs, or to the extent to which drug development hasn't gone forward? So there is a contested literature out there already on measuring that question. The question is there a problem with gridlock empirically? I'm fairly confident that there is. Others are fairly confident that there is not. But that even that very basic question is an empirical one that is difficult to measure. There's been some recent work in business schools that I found very interesting on negotiation research, which is where some researchers did a study where this is Ben DePorter and Sven Vanesta, another group, where they did a study asking business people to negotiate a solution to a tragedy of the commons. They structured a problem in a way that they had to work together to overcome a tragedy of the commons. And they did reasonably well. And then they had another group of negotiators try to solve the exact same problem, the identical problem, but the problem was presented to them in anti-commons form rather than in commons form. And it turns out that people were much less good. And they did this experiment in a fairly controlled way in various versions of it, and their findings, which were fairly robust, are that people are much less good at even seeing or spotting or solving some negotiation dilemma where there's money on the table, where the problem is presented to them in anti-commons form, where it's the problem of solving the problem of underuse. They're much less familiar with it. So that's a piece of empirical, psychological, business school research that suggests that we have a long way to go in making visible to people the costs of underuse. As you go sector by sector of the economy, I think there's a lot of room for trying to measure the deterred innovation from property rights gridlock, from gridlock in the economy. But I think it's doable. It takes better empirical researchers than I to do it. And I absolutely look forward to your listeners who are able to tease out the cost of gridlock.
We're talking with and have talked to Professor Michael Heller of Columbia Law School, author of the book The Gridlock Economy. Michael, for those people that want to learn more about you and your work, where can they go?
They should go to the book's website, which is www.gridlockeconomy.com. The website then will link them on to my blog and to resources about the book.
Are there any projects coming up that you want to presage here on the show?
Well, I've been part of what happens when you write a book is that you get invited to talk in a lot of audiences like this one, and I think there's I actually am more optimistic since the book came out, in part because there are a lot of people on the Hill, a lot of academic researchers who have some pretty creative ideas for how to move forward with solving gridlock. So I think patent reform, copyright law reform, FCC reforms, antitrust reforms, there's a lot of different directions to go, and we have a government that now that seems pretty interested in doing that. So I think there's room for optimism.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture and discussing your very important book, and I look forward to inviting you back on the show and in a few years when the gridlock economy is gone. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to mention a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture. This quarter is coming to a quick end, and so I will be looking at new shows airing in September. But among the guests coming up will be Siva Vaidyanathan, a professor at University of Virginia, discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything. Kazis Barnelis and Geert Lovink will be discussing technology theory. Professor Alex Alex Halavay of Quinnipiac University will be on discussing his book, The Search Engine Society. Professor Gordon Hull of University of North Carolina, Charlotte, will be on discussing technology ethics. Professor Wendy Chun will be on the show discussing her work in the area of race identity in technology. Professors Frank Pasquale and Danielle Citron will be on the show discussing their work involving fusion centers. Professor Tarleton Gillespie of Cornell University will be on discussing his work in copyright. Annalie Newitz from Texploitation will be on the show. Professor Bobby Qual from DePaul University School of Law will be on discussing her new book, as well as Professor Jackie Lipton from my alma mater, Case Western Reserve University School of Law, discussing her work in copyright and trademark, as well as Laura DeNardis of the Yale Information Society Project discussing her book involving technology and democracy. As always, you can listen to the show by coming to KZSU and listening from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time on Wednesdays. You can also listen to the show by podcast by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. That's CIS's, Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage, and subscribing to the RSS feed. You can also go to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society and pick up the podcast. And you can always pick up the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can listen to all previous shows and see the upcoming schedule. As always, I encourage your comments, suggestions, feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening today, and I will look forward to talking to you again soon. Have a great day, and please continue to listen to KZSU FM Stanford.